Welcome to the Oldie Literary Lunch, sponsored by Noble Caledonia, the world experts in small ship cruising.
Our author reveals the latest chapter in his Margaret Thatcher saga, in which he's mapped her progress to the height of power, inexorably one finest hour after another, until the tide began to turn. And yet again we readers learn that in politics there comes a time when a fall can follow the preceding climb. And enough. I now invite to take the floor our very own Boswell. Welcome, Charles Moore.
Come behind the chair. Thank you very much, Barry, Harry, ladies and that's a rhyme along Barry's style, by the way. And ladies and gentlemen, I apologise for being late and missing the actual lunch, but I have made it in time. In the lavatory just beforehand, I met Barry, and he said something about the parrot joke. And because I was thinking about Thatcher all the time, I thought he meant the famous Mrs. Thatcher parrot story, but I don't think he did, and so I'll quickly tell it to you. Some of you may know it already, but it is interesting. In 1990, the Liberal Democrats floated for the first time as a symbol, a bird. And in fact, they have it still. And they were rising in the polls and they won the Eastbourne by-election. And Mrs. Thatcher was coming up to her annual party conference. And because of this bird, one of her speechwriters, I think it was John O'Sullivan, thought that she ought to mock the Liberal bird by using the Monty Python dead parrot sketch. And so he suggested this to her, and she hadn't heard of the dead parrot sketch, and she hadn't heard of Monty Python. And she listened gravely, and she said, is it funny? And John O'Sullivan said, yes, it's very, very funny, Prime Minister. And he explained it a little bit, and it wasn't her sort of thing, and she absolutely didn't understand. So she said, could we have the video in, and I'll watch it. Being conscientious in everything. And so in it came, and Mrs. Thatcher, with her speechwriters, watched it, and because they were so nervous about her reaction, throughout the dead parrot sketch, they kept falling off their chair, laughing hysterically at every moment of the sketch. Mrs. Thatcher sat through it, not with pompous disapproval, but with absolute incomprehension, 100% not understanding it. But she did sort of persevere. And by the way, what part of the surreal quality of all of this is that while this was going on, she was deciding that Britain should enter the ERM, which of course she did very much against her will. And so the records show that half the time she's sitting there working on her speech and talking about the dead parrot, and the other half she's having to go out of the room to speak in front of the Treasury about how we're entering, or number 10 actually, I think, outside number 10, how we're entering the ERM at this point, this great climactic moment in history, back and forth between the parrot and the exchange rate mechanism. And she rehearsed it all, as she always did, with tremendous care. So she'd always go into the conference hall when nobody was in it and do a full rehearsal and went right through it. And she still really disliked it. And she, one thing she disliked, I think she knew that John Cleese was a liberal and had indeed advertised the liberals. And when she saw him doing it, she commented that she didn't think he did it very well. the dead parrot, I mean. So it went on, and on the day, she was always very, very nervous before the party conference speech. It was always the most nerve-wracking thing. On the day, she went behind stage with John Whittingdale, her advisor, about to enter the hall and stand on the platform and deliver it. And she turned to John at this key moment, and she said, John, this Monty Python, is he one of us? John Whittingdale, very sensibly at this point, thought there's absolutely no mileage in explaining. He said, yes, Prime Minister, he's a very great supporter. And on she went, and she delivered it absolutely brilliantly, superb acting. Everybody, you know, the crowd rose and chapped and cleared and roared with laughter, and she was absolutely none the wiser for what she'd been talking about. This third, and you'll be pleased to hear, final volume goes from 87 victory until her death. And I just want to say a couple of things about it. And what I thought I'd do in this very brief time is tell you a couple of things in it which surprised me and therefore may surprise you. The first is about Mrs. Thatcher and AIDS. AIDS came along as a major issue in the mid-80s in Britain. And it was very frightening because people thought it might be a plague. They didn't really know how you got it. They didn't really know who was likely to get it. And above all, they didn't know whether you could do anything about it. So it was a tremendously difficult health education problem, preventative problem, and so on. And Mrs. Thatcher was torn in various ways. She was torn by anxiety about whether it be too explicit, the sort of advertising that we should have, and therefore invite people to the practices that we were trying to discourage. So, for example, I noticed she writes on one piece of paper, do we have to have the section on risky sex? She writes, well, I think the view was, yes, we do have to. And because she always believed in knowledge and the importance of scientific fact, she accepted that. It's generally thought that she was rather censorious about such matters, sexual behaviour. This was not the case. She was herself very proper, and she's extremely innocent, so she didn't really know what a homosexual was, not really. And she employed a great many of them and was always trying to get them married to her secretaries without without success. But she eventually thought that she ought to go and visit a hospital where AIDS victims were and meet AIDS victims. And she went to the Mildmay Hospital. And she met two AIDS victims, both of whom were dying. And she went with Caroline Slocock, her private secretary. And one of the two was very, was sort of rather demented by his AIDS and was hysterical. And once he realized it really was Mrs. Thatcher, he was terribly sort of overexcited, and it was all very difficult. And Caroline Slocock was completely amazed by how good Mrs. Thatcher was in this situation. She just went on talking calmly to him, holding his hand and calming him down. And Mrs. Thatcher couldn't believe how well she'd done this. Caroline Slocock couldn't believe how well she'd done this. And they left. And later, a letter came from the matron of the hospital, saying that the patient had died, one of the two patients had died. And Mrs. Thatcher immediately wrote back and said how grateful she was for the visit and enclosed a cheque for £1,000 for the hospital of her own money. And what I think is very interesting about all of this is that she never told anybody. Nowadays, a politician wouldn't bother to visit a hospital if there weren't a lot of cameras in tow. She absolutely didn't tell anybody. It was a secret visit, well, a private visit, and I think all that's rather striking. The other one I wanted to mention about was about South Africa. We all know that Margaret Thatcher was very much against sanctions against South Africa, and this was a very important and part of her argument about how you would move to a multiracial society without economic and political collapse. And it separated her from most of the Commonwealth. And this was true, this was absolutely what she thought, and it enabled her actually to engage with F.W. de Klerk, the new leader of South Africa, after P.W. Botha went, and to help bring about the peaceful end of apartheid. But what people are not so aware of is that though she was always saying, we won't talk to terrorists, and she regarded the ANC as at least in part a terrorist organization, she actually ran a dual-track policy. So while she was saying such things and constantly holding out against sanctions, she authorised secret discussions with the ANC, with Oliver Tambo, who was the leader in exile, who was based here, with the leadership in Lusaka, with people like Thabo Mbeki. And there were talks in Britain, and there were meetings in London, and there were contacts both at a secret level and at a ministerial level, though not directly with Mrs. Thatcher. And Mandela, personally, and she'd been calling for his release since 1984, he personally had, though obviously he didn't agree with her about most things, he conceived a high regard for her because of what she'd done with Gorbachev. He had noticed how she had changed the whole atmosphere of the Cold War by moving from a very strong position about nuclear build-up to reaching out to the new generation, a Soviet leader who might change. And indeed, she persuaded Reagan of the importance of Gorbachev. And Mandela had been very struck by that, and he thought something like that can happen in South Africa. and he thought, I think, not only that F.W. de Klerk could, as it were, be South Africa's Gorbachev, but almost that he, Mandela, could be South Africa's Gorbachev, that he could be the one who made it all different and reframed the whole argument. Anyway, he was freed, he started to do all sorts of, this was in February 1990, and he started to do all sorts of world tours that followed from his acclamation after he left. And because the British had a very good relationship with him privately, the British deep state, as they say, when he got very, very tired, because he was quite old already by then on the world tours, he let it be known that he would like to come and have a little tiny holiday in Britain, a secret holiday, and could it be arranged? And so the deep state provided a country house near Tunbridge Wells where Mandela and Mrs. Mandela could come for this secret sort of R&R. And they also provided that Oliver Tambo and his wife, who hadn't met the Mandelas, they were great friends, of course, but they hadn't met since 1963 because Mandela had been in prison, came to this weekend. So Mandela came, he enjoyed himself greatly, and Mandela was, when he drank alcohol, he wouldn't drink cold alcohol. He said it hurt his stomach. He liked hot alcohol. And so he drank a glass and a half of hot port at dinner and got very excited and telephoned Mrs. Thatcher in the middle of the night. He got through at 11:45 at night to number 10, where the indefatigable Charles Pole was still up. And he spoke to Charles being her private secretary, foreign affairs private secretary. And he said, you know, I'm really keen to see Mrs. Thatcher. There's so much to talk about. And Charles immediately wrote this in a memo to Mrs. Thatcher. Charles said, well, that'd be marvellous. I'm sure it could be arranged, but what's your timing? And he said, well, I'm in Tunbridge Wells, and I've got to be at Heathrow by 10 tomorrow morning. And this was midnight. So it wasn't easy. But Charles, and indeed they couldn't meet on that occasion, but Charles wrote her a note in the middle of the night. I think she was still up, and she usually was still up at that time. Anyway, the note reached her, and at 7:30 the following morning, she and Mandela had a telephone conversation from Tunbridge Wells to Downing Street, which Mandela liked very much because she was so solicitous. Because though she could be so fierce, she was very motherly about things like illness and being tired. She was always worried that men were very tired in a way that women weren't. And so she said, you know, I do hope you're resting and all that sort of thing. And Mandela found that very charming. And then when they did meet, which was in July that year, it was a very successful meeting. For the first time almost in history, Mrs. Thatcher shut up for 50 minutes without saying anything at all in order to listen to Mandela. And they talked for so long that the press entourage outside were heard to chant, "Free Nelson Mandela." I'll just end with, because one aspect of this book is that, of course, she goes from, as Barry was mentioning, from the height of power to her fall, and then becomes, you couldn't really say a private citizen, but eventually an old lady, and sadly, with diminishing mental powers. And I write about this towards the end of the book. And I just wanted to tell you the sort of character of how that took her, because it interests me. The example I take is a visit when she went to stay with Charles and Carla Pole, because Carla Pole, Charles's wife, is Italian, near Rome in 2009. So Mrs. Thatcher was already, what would that be? Yes, over 80, 83 or something like that. And she was not in a good mental state, though she was fairly serene, but she was confused. And I was there, and one of the purposes with her, and one of the purposes of this was to meet the Pope. And talking to Mrs. Thatcher beforehand, I said, isn't it marvellous we're going to see the Pope? This is Pope Benedict. And she said, yes, but what does one say to a Pope? Which do think is a good question. That's not something I'm ever able to answer. Anyway, we went at the polls, and myself and my wife and Lady Thatcher, Carol chickened out, I noticed. She was also staying, but she had decided she'd rather be in the swimming pool than go through with all of this. We went to the Vatican, and we had St. Peter's Basilica to ourselves, because it was a general audience outside, and they cleared the basilica. And Lady Thatcher went to pray at the tomb of John Paul II. And then we waited, and then we then brought Lady Thatcher out to meet Pope Benedict. And the answer to the question, what does one say to a Pope, is that actually the other person with me looking after her was Paul Johnson. He went on and on talking to the Pope. So that solved that one. And Lady Thatcher and the Pope exchanged a few courtly words, and that was that. And it was then my task to take her down to her car, which is at the bottom of St. Peter's Square. So all the crowds by this time had recognised her and were all clapping and very interested. And anyone's been who's been to one of these general audiences, you will remember that newly married couples stand there in a sort of pen to be blessed by the Pope. And as I walked along with Lady Thatcher, she saw them and she rushed up to them and she said, "We did that a long time ago," meaning we got married. And it's a wonderful thing to do. And so they were all very delighted. And she passed on down, and sort of crowd letting her through and clapping and things. And as we reached the car, I said, because I could see that was good, I said, "Lady Thatcher, they want to photograph you." And then I could see a moment of doubt crossing her, because she was wearing a mantilla, you know. So she said, "I'll take this thing off," meaning this thing, so that it would be a better photograph. And then I could see she was worried about whether her hair, which is always so beautifully arranged, would be disarranged. So I said, which was true, actually wasn't in a minute, I said, "You look fantastic." And then she turned, and she did that great sort of celebrity sweep of a wave, which can take in the whole of whatever Bernini designed. And they all clapped and cheered, all photographed her, and she got in the car. But the point really that I'm making is that an hour later, she had no memory that she'd seen the Pope. It's this incredible ability to continue to perform, you know, to do your duty, even when you don't really know what it is. Thanks very much.
For more about the Oldie magazine, Amber Lunches, go to theoldie.co.uk.